The OTB Podcast Network with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein-powered chicken bites.
Okay, so the Champions League returns this week with the quarterfinals, and what better way to celebrate the return of the Champions League than to speak to one of the voices, if not the voice, of big European nights, Clive Tilsley. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I want to start talking about commentarycharts.com here, because anybody who follows you on social media will not only know what these charts are, basically where you can purchase a framed version of any commentary notes that you commentated on, any of the big games from the past, but they are accompanied essentially by videos of you writing them out, which I must say is one of the most relaxing things you can possibly watch on the internet right now.
Time lapse is a wonderful thing. I don't do them quite that quickly. I mean, they are essential props for commentators. As the late, great, truly great Brian Moore used to say, fail to prepare and you prepare to fail. I do believe that anybody with a will and the kind of sort of anal nature, that anorak nature that commentators have, could do the research and compile the charts. And they're all very individual. Obviously, some are written out, some are compiled on a tablet of some kind. But if there is a skill to our job, it's how you use the information, when you use the information, if you use the information, how much of the information on them you use. And I've certainly always been schooled to believe that we are journalists, broadcast journalists, that we do need to editorialize. And so the commentators that reel off the fruits of their labours, whether it's actually relevant to the moment or to the match or not, are, in my opinion, to be avoided. I think if I use more than 10% of the information that I've compiled on a commentary chart for a game, then I'm probably boring the viewer or the listener to death. I think, as much as anything, they're a kind of psychological prop that if you compile something which is complete and looks good, it looks like you've taken care over it, then when the red light comes on, you certainly get a degree of confidence radiating back to you that, well, at least I've done my prep.
Yeah, for sure. Has your prep changed in any way over the years? Like, are you still writing up everything, every single letter for matches nowadays?
Yeah, I am, believe it or not, computer literate, but I think perhaps I'm from an era where schooling was writing out and learning and remembering. And so perhaps that's ingrained in me, that by writing out, it goes into this thick skull a little better than it would do otherwise. But it's just part of the process, really. I think... Well, you often hear professional athletes talking about the process, you know, their pre-match rituals, which are all a little different within a single dressing room. And as I say, we're all very individual in the way that we prepare. But this is essentially the way that I've always done my prep. I think, particularly in the last year, the whole art of communication has changed because the circumstances have changed. And you've got to reflect that. The provision and consumption of media changes by the minute generally. And so it's very important if you're to try to stay relevant and therefore, you know, keep resonating, keep connecting with a mass audience, that you're across the different trends and the different way that, as I say, the media is actually absorbed. I think perhaps the broadcasts have changed and hopefully the commentaries have developed, but in a weird sort of way, probably not. The actual notes are probably look pretty much the same as they did 150 years ago when I first commentated.
They look absolutely fantastic. And as I say, commentarycharts.com, if anybody's listening and only hearing about this for the first time, make sure to go on there to check it out. Another big project of yours this year, Clive, is your book, Not For Me, Clive, Stories from the Voice of Football, coming out this May, I think you said. And I know you've been on the show before talking about 99 and Istanbul and your very famous commentaries in the early days of your European commentaries. I'm interested in actually, when was your first experience of European nights as a boy, when the European Cup was starting to develop in the 1960s? What do you remember of that time?
Well, I was brought up as a Manchester United fan. I believe it or not, when I came home from the nursing home, to my first ever home. We lived next door to the manager of Bury Football Club. We were in a semi-detached house separated only by a wall from the manager of Bury Football Club. You could walk to Gig Lane from our house. I should have been a Bury fan. My mum took me to Gig Lane before I was born, when she was pregnant, because she'd go watch the games with my Auntie Gladys, with, you know, Dave Russell's wife. But my dad was a Manchester United fan. He, through the Busby Babes era, through the 50s and stuff. So from a very early age, from 4 or 5 years of age, he was taking me to home games at Old Trafford. And so, yeah, I saw Bess Law and Charlton in the flesh from my sort of very early experiences of watching football. And I saw them playing in the European Cup. I saw them playing against Real Madrid and Milan and so on. And I can never explain it, and can certainly never explain it to the fan of any football club. But Manchester United left me when I started to work in local radio, which was straight from university, 21 years of age. I started to cover Nottingham Forest home and away for a commercial radio station. I was spending half my time with the players. They were the same age as me. They were my mates. And suddenly, because I was watching my mates play, I kind of supported them, really. I wanted them to win. And to this day, I'm still the same. I don't have a team, don't have a club, but I've got lots of friends in the business, and my affections go with them. But my first experience of European nights, I didn't actually go to the final in 68. My dad didn't have tickets for Manchester United at Wembley. But I remember them going out in a semi-final and being there at Old Trafford. So in the late 60s, I was actually watching what is now Champions League football in the flesh.
It's interesting that a few moments ago you referred to the journalism aspect of your job. And I guess that really came to the fore in your time with covering the Nottingham Forest beat, but also covering Manchester United under Sir Alex Ferguson. And I guess the information that you had to glean that maybe just isn't possible from a commentator standpoint anymore.
The biggest change that I've witnessed in all those 150 years is the relationship between football and its media. It is totally different now from what it was. It isn't a relationship now, really. It is a kind of marriage of convenience. You'll still find broadcasters and journalists who've got good contacts and got good friends within the business. But even those friendships are kind of compromised by the nature of 21st century media. You've almost kind of have two different relationships with these guys, because information is so precious and so toxic, really, that it was difficult enough when you were in the confidence of Sir Alex Ferguson, and two or three of us would meet him in the grill room at Old Trafford at 4 o'clock on the day of a big Champions League night on ITV, and he would tell us his team. And tell us why he'd chosen that team. He would trust us with the fact that Roy Keane has picked up a calf injury in training this morning, that he's leaving Beckham out, that he's playing Giggs in centre midfield. And funny enough, you just mentioned the book. I've actually written about it, that walking back down the steps from the grill room out into the outside world, it felt like you were kind of as part of some sort of affair. You had this kind of secret from the rest of the world, and you'd walk out into the thoroughfare and somebody would shout across, "Hey, Clive, what do you think tonight? 2-0, Beckham and Giggs to score." They're not playing. it was almost too much. I mean, sometimes you'd go into the tunnel before the game, like 70, 80 minutes before the game. And one of the officials of the club, the security guy said, "Have you heard that Keno's injured?" "Oh, no, don't tell me it's out, because he'll blame me." So it was like classified information. And it's very rare that you have. I've probably got, in the Premier League now, I've probably got relationships of that kind with four managers, something like that. And that's because we go back a long way, Sam Allardyce, Steve Bruce, Chris Wilder, whatever. So there isn't the trust between football and its media anymore. It is so, clickbait journalism that's out there, it makes it very difficult, even for a sort of, you know, P-list celebrity like me. You've got to be careful, and you've got to be wary of social media and stuff. So if you're living life in a goldfish bowl, like a top Premier League player or manager, I don't think you trust anybody.
Did you ever see the tougher side of Ferguson firsthand? I'm not sure, did you ever get the hairdryer treatment?
Yeah, just the two.
Right.
One on the telephone, thankfully. I wasn't actually in the presence of one of them. I mean, the stories would take too long to tell, and they are both in the book. But I was innocent on both counts. They were total misunderstandings.
Well, which was the worst one? And I'm sure
in the flesh, in the foyer of a hotel at Port Olympic in Barcelona, before a Champions League game. Funny enough, in the same season in 98-99, United played in the Nou Camp in the group stage. A wonderful game, actually, 3-3 draw. And how can I tell this quickly?
But take your time.
I did have another source at Manchester United. And so I was kind of privy to a little bit of information. But the great Hugh McIlvany, wonderful sports writer, was very close to Sir Alex Ferguson. And in his Sunday Times preview, he had speculated Phil Neville was playing right back at the time. Gary Neville was playing at centre back. And he speculated that Fergie might bring Wes Brown into the team at right back because he'd be playing against Rivaldo, who, quite apart from being brilliant, was quite a big unit. And so it was purely a hype thing. And so if it was in Huey's piece, I kind of read between the lines that this was Jen. So, you know, my commentary chart the night before had Wes Brown and not Phil Neville on it. Anyway, I came back from the kind of ITV pre-match dinner early as I was a good boy and wanted a good night's sleep. And I just happened to get into the lift with the father, Neville Neville, the father of Gary and Phil Neville. And our conversation only lasted however many floors we went up. But during it, he said, Phil's worried he's not playing tomorrow. And I said, well, if he doesn't play, if he doesn't play, Nev, it will only be because of the height. And I think Fergie's a bit concerned about Rivaldo. And that was the conversation. But Nev didn't go to bed. Nev phoned Phil and said, Clive Tuzzi doesn't think you're playing either. And Phil told Gary, and Gary was the shop steward. And at breakfast next morning, confronted Fergie and said, Clive Tilsley knows the team. We don't know the team, which wasn't quite the case. So when we had our lunchtime meeting down at the, I went with Bob Wilson, the lovely Bob Wilson, and we walked through the doors of the hotel and Fergie's there. And we're expecting the, hi, how are you? You know, whatever. Bang, bang, bang. So I had the, you know, one of the most, famous faces, one of the most respected people in the whole of European life, let alone football, bawling at me from about five paces in the foyer of a busy hotel. And, I was off the planet. I wasn't to be seen anywhere in the solar system for the next couple of weeks, if possible. I think that was the kind of message. And I left without any time to say, but I only read it in the Sunday Times. Now, the nature of Sir Alec was that these things went one of two ways. Either you were, there was an omerta and you were cast off for the rest of your life, you know, as happened to the BBC, Steve Bruce, Roy Keane, Mrs. Beckham, you name it, you know, that's it, end of. Or it blew over in two or three days and we carried on as if, I'm still waiting for the apology. And I'm not holding my breath for that. But I was back on board within a few days, and as if it had never happened. And the other one was a similar misunderstanding. But it was, God rest him now, it was all Hugh McIlvany's fault.
That must be pretty terrifying at the time. I'm not sure how many expeditors were thrown in, but... that experience, do you even remember the content of what he specifically said to you?
No, the other one I remember in a nutshell was I got the real rollicking on the phone next day, but I actually got I was dismissed from his presence in his company. It was at the end of after a nothing League Cup tie, first leg League Cup tie away to Halifax Town, who were the bottom of the Football League at the time. And Manchester United actually won 3-1, but they played rubbish. And there was a second leg to come. It really didn't matter. And we were doing it for highlights, regional highlights. And when I came down from the gantry, I was told that the interviews, the floor manager told me the interviews were with Jim McCalliog, who the name some people remember, who was the manager of Halifax at the time. Really famous Scottish international, cup winner and stuff. And with Neil Webb, who'd scored one of the United goals. Fergie wasn't appearing. Now, ITV had a national network game involving Manchester United the following weekend. And unbeknown to me, my boss at Granada TV in Manchester, Paul Doherty, who's the son of the great Peter Doherty, had somehow managed to get through to the office at Halifax, get a message to Fergie that we'd really like just two questions relating purely to the game at Nottingham Forest coming up. Now, we didn't have mobile phones back in the late 17th century, so this part of the message didn't reach me. So to my surprise, after we'd interviewed McCalliog and Webb, Fergie starts striding from the tunnel to our position by the pit side, clearing his... He always had a really kind of nervous cough when he was irritated, which was always a bad sign, and just presented himself for interview. So, of course, Muggins goes straight in with, well, a 3-1 win, Sir Alec, but what did you think of the performance? Nothing, really. So I went in with a follow-up question, and he looked at me, and this sort of bubble came out of his head. Written inside it was, are you seriously asking me this? And get ready for it, folks. I got a big index finger in the chest. He said, fucking cancer. And turned around and was gone. And as he went back into the tunnel, the floor manager came out with the news that Fergie's cut, but you're only to ask him about the game. Okay. So again, misunderstanding. And I was naive enough then to think that a phone call, I had the number of his direct line on his desk, still at the Cliff training ground. He's always in at 7:30. I'll phone him at 7:45 in the morning. Explained that I didn't know and everything would be fine, but I miscalculated on that. And I think sitting in a suburban bedroom on the Wirral with the phone in my hand, I think the neighbours could hear that I was again not to appear at Old Trafford for a little while, but it blew over.
Listen, it takes a thick skin. Fair play for bouncing back so quickly, because that could make a young reporter crumble in that sort of situation.
Well, I mean, I'd like to reflect and think it was part of an initiation ceremony. Sure. I don't think that was the guy. I think he has lost it with me a couple of times. He was and is. I've only bumped into him once really in the last few years, and we picked up as if. As if the intervening years hadn't happened. He was very, very good to me. I was very fortunate. I inherited a trusting relationship from Brian Moore. And I actually worked with Jason, one of Stronic's sons at Granada TV. He was a match director. He was the guy in my ear for quite a few games. And I'd been to the family home. I'd actually been back to the Ferguson residence in Wilmslow a couple of times and stayed. So, I was always aware that it was essentially a professional relationship. I think we talked about the commentary charts before. The original commentary charts of the two Manchester United Champions League victories on his watch, he bought from me. He gave donation to, I'm a patron of the Bobby Moore Fund, and he gave, four-figure donation on each occasion. Right. And he had them framed in his office. And a lot of people, the managers who visited the training centre commented on these, that they were like pride of place on his office wall. He often referred to them when visitors came. So I'd like to think that he kind of respected my thoroughness, my professionalism, and that with the inherent trust that I brought forward from Jason, from Brian Moore, You know, I didn't let him. He's aware that I didn't let him down in it. This is probably the biggest letdown I've ever, by writing about it in the book. So I'd be interested to see if I get another. I might get the hat trick after the book's published. But in the chapter, I talk. Each of the chapters in the book has got the title of a famous, mainly football, but some broadcasting people that I've come across and been close to at some stage. You know, Shanks, Kenny, Suey, Gareth, Cloughy, and so on. But the chapters are not specifically about that person. And the Fergie chapter is about power, really, about the difficulty for the contemporary manager to control everything in his or her domain. And, you know, we're now in the era of the technical director and the director of football and the head of recruitment and so on. And, of course, Fergie held all of those posts at Manchester United because that's the way that he wanted it. That's the way he demanded it, really. It's the only way he felt that he could exercise that level of control over his kingdom. And it worked because he was prepared to be at his desk at 7:30 every morning, prepared to deal with all of that. And because he adapted wonderfully to change. I've written in the book about how managing Ryan Giggs was very different to managing Cristiano Ronaldo, how recruiting Ryan Giggs was going round to his parents' house in Swinton, knocking on the door and going in and trying to persuade them he would look after him, how recruiting Cristiano Ronaldo was sitting down with George Mendes and, you know, having a conversation with him. So and that was Fergie's brilliance. And that hairdryer was put away about halfway through his career, really, because he, in the same way you have to parent differently today than you did probably 20 years ago, you have to manage differently. And Sir Alec was very, very good at adapting to that as long as he could keep control of his domain. And listen, I've got no great insight into what happened with Rock of Gibraltar, but it was the one fight outside of, it was the one away match that he played in his time, really, where he was fighting on foreign soil, mainly on Irish soil, really, against people who were as powerful in their domain as he was in his, except he was fighting them in their domain, on their ground, on their terms, really.
Yeah.
And he didn't have that. He couldn't exercise that power over a situation that he had over most things at Manchester United. So it's a kind of, I think it's a fascinating look at how people in positions of power in football now have to manage differently to how they once did.
It sounds like it's going to be an absolutely fascinating chapter in the book. I just wanted to ask you as well, Clive, before we wrap up, about Jack Charlton, because there's a new documentary, Finding Jack Charlton, which is absolutely brilliant. It's aired in Ireland and in the UK over the last week or so. And when Jack passed away last summer, I remember your own Twitter video, which I think has got over a million views at this point, telling a brilliant anecdote about Jack. What was he like on a professional level from the broadcast side of things?
He absolutely as he seems. You got what you saw with Jack. It's some people are able to put on a front and have a public persona. That was Jack. That was absolutely how he was. Difficult, you know. I mean, it is a wonderful film. It's not a documentary; it's a film, again, the trust that the guy, know the filmmaker very well, Gabriel Clark, and made the Bobby Robson film too, and the trust that the family must have invested in Gabriel to tell the story, to even to, you know, to have the access to shoot Jack in his later life, must have been very testing for the family, because you've been around cameras; they're not, you know, they're great big things, and they come with a sound recordings and some wires and stuff, and it's very difficult for anything happen naturally in front of a camera. But Jack called a spade, and I thought there were some wonderful contributions on the football side. Andy Townsend was great in it, because Andy's a big friend and a wonderful raconteur, great storyteller. But Andy was kind of quite hard, quite honest about how difficult Jack could be, and I think that gave us a proper insight into a lovable man, but his own man. And yeah, I mean, funny enough, one of the commentary charts we've got is Italy in New York, or not New York, in New Jersey. And you know, for the guys that went out there, that's football. You know, that's what we haven't got at the moment. Those just extraordinary, I was there memories, you know, and they come not just with Ray's goal, but with the whole trip and finding the money to go on the trip and coming back and meeting your mates who didn't go and telling them all about it. That whole experience, if you traveled from the island to New Jersey and witnessed that and come back, I mean, listen, you know, we all give the right answer when we're asked what's the one most wonderful moment in your life. Oh, being at the birth of my, yeah, maybe. I mean, no, honestly, I did go to Giant State. Ah, well, there you go. That was it then. That was the greatest moment in your life. Yeah, but don't tell the wife.
it's a pretty good way to leave it, Clive. I really appreciate your time. I think we are almost out of time. Great memories of Jack Charlton. I highly advise people to check out the film as you describe it as well. Keep an eye out for Clive's book as well. Not For Me, Clive, is how it's titled, coming out this May, and of course commentarycharts.com for Clive's immediate work at the moment. It's been great chatting to you. So many things we didn't get to, but I'm sure we'll catch up with you again. Clive Tilsley, thank you.
The OTB Podcast Network, with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.